7BR Part Heard. Hello and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. This week, I'm joined by Mariam Syed and Vittoria Trudilio to discuss the proposed changes to jury trials which have been made in recent weeks. Mariam is a highly regarded criminal and family practitioner with significant experience in dealing with serious, complex and high-profile cases. She's a Grade 4 prosecutor and sits as a judge of the first-tier tribunal in the regulatory chamber, as well as a Crown Court recorder in London and the South East. Vittoria has developed a strong criminal practice since she was called to the bar in 2013. She's regularly instructed in serious cases in the Crown Court and has appeared in the Court of Appeal. Mariam and Vittoria, welcome to the podcast. The backlog of cases due to be tried in criminal courts is no new phenomenon. But with the closure of physical courts in recent months adding to the pressure, there have been suggestions that changes should be made to jury trials. These have included scrapping them altogether for either way offences in favour of a single judge and two magistrates to, more recently, reducing the number of people sitting on a jury from 12 to 7. Mariam, to the layperson, these proposals might seem to have come out of the blue and appear quite drastic, but what is the background to this and how did we get here?
Well, hi, Ellie. It's really good to be talking to you and Vittoria today on this really important subject. Well, as you say, COVID-19 caused all jury trials to be suspended on the 23rd of March of this year. And as lockdown continued, the backlog in jury trials just went up and up. And so there had to be a discussion about the possibilities of actually changing the fundamentals of our jury system. And the thinking, as you say, has moved over the months from a judge-only trial for certain offences, a judge and two magistrates for either way offences as a possibility for a defendant to elect, or lowering the actual number of jurors from 12 to 7 or 9. And most recently, the Justice Secretary, Robert Buckland, has actually expressed a favour for the latter. But equally in tandem, there's also been the alternative notion of introducing Nightingale or Blackstone courts, which is normal 12-member jury trials to be held in non-court buildings, and extending court hours in afternoon and morning sessions. So there's been a lot of discussion about all of that, and the leaders of the Bar Council and the Law Society have actually voiced their opposition in principle to changing the jury trial system as recently as the 3rd of July in a joint statement. And how we got here, as you say, is interesting because the genesis of this actually started before lockdown, because there was a reduction in sitting days, which meant that there was already nearly 40,000 trials outstanding. And so it wasn't unusual before lockdown to wait 9 to 12 months for your trial to be fixed from the first date you were given in the Crown Court. And as somebody who sits as a recorder in the Crown Court, I know that the sitting days were cut. And ironically, I was due to sit for the first time in ages in London when COVID shut it down. So the C word has really exacerbated what was a difficult problem already.
So, Vittoria, in terms of that C word, how has COVID-19 impacted the backlog? And what do you think of this blue sky thinking advocated by the Lord Chief Justice?
It's fair to say that COVID-19 has had an impact, but perhaps it's not had the impact that some people seem to be placing at its door. Because we know, for example, that the backlog is not a new problem. In December 2019, so pre-COVID, there was a backlog of over 37,000 cases awaiting trial in the Crown Court. So COVID certainly made it worse, but it's not the sole cause. As Mariam has said, there's been a reduction in sitting days, and there's also been the issue of a capacity of the court estate, where essentially a lot of courts have been sold off. Most recently, Blackfriars Crown Court, which is a really well-functioning Crown Court in central London, has gone. And now courts like Stairsbrook Crown Court are having to deal with the cases that Blackfriars would have dealt with before. So there's really an issue in terms of capacity, sitting days, funding at every level. And yeah, COVID's made it a lot worse. In terms of blue sky thinking, there's definitely been various way forward suggested. There's the issues of Blackstone courts, and there have been projects dealing with whether jury trials can be held remotely. So the Justice Project, for example, has been trialling and seeing if they could replicate a realistic immersive experience for a jury trial. But I think that there are concerns even dealing with that type of way forward, because whilst remote working can work really well in certain areas of the criminal justice system, I think that there's potential issues as to whether you can replicate what happens in a jury trial in a way that's completely remote. There's a sensory element that's really important for a jury to assess. They look at the evidence, they can touch things, they see the way that things are packaged, and they can assess people's demeanor and cues that are nonverbal. And whether that can be replicated over a link is, I think, at the very least, doubtful. And there's also the fact that in a courtroom, the jury are together. They go to the break room together, they chat, they know each other, and they interact. And so their deliberation evolves with the evidence. And whether that is something that can be achieved in a completely remote setting, I think remains to be seen.
Some of these suggestions are definitely ambitious. What are some of the practical realities of some of these proposals, Mary?
Well, Ellie, that's actually a really, really good question, because one of the biggest problems that the HMCTS and the judiciary are having to deal with is actually a logistical one, and it's to do with court sizes. So although we may have big court centres, which can have up to 20 courtrooms per building, some of the courts are actually quite small. And if you have to factor in what was 2 metres and now 1 metre plus social distancing rules to actually fit in the number of court participants that you actually need for a trial has proved almost impossible. And that's why it's taken such a while for trials, even involving a single defendant, to come on. And one of the biggest problems that everyone is grappling with at the moment is what to do with multi-handed cases, because it's not just the size of the courtroom, it's the size of the dock. So at the moment, 1 defendant per dock, possibly 2, maybe at a push 3. But if you have more than that, what are you going to do? And in relation to other people who play an important part in the court process, intermediaries, interpreters and screens, that's all, again, proved really difficult. And I know a number of judges who've actually got their tape measure out, gone into their courtrooms and got on their hands and knees and started measuring exactly what can be done. And there's also this factor that we have an open system of justice. So it's not just those who are directly involved in a court case, but it's also, you know, members of the public, the press, family members. And as I'm sure you'll know, at the moment, the cases that are being heard, for example, at the Bailey, which are running a number of trials, they're having to operate across multiple courts at the same time. One court for a number of parties, one court for family and public, one court for others. And so it is a balancing exercise. And I think there is all of that to be dealt with. And we're going to have to look at how that is going to move on. And there is a concern, I think, as the backlog piles up, that there are some defendants who are playing a waiting game to see if witnesses may be dissuaded, and it might be worth their while just to wait it out. But equally, there's a really important concern for defendants, often very young defendants and vulnerable defendants, who are in custody, anxiously waiting their trials. So, Ellie, the practical realities is a really important point.
Victoria, what evidence is there available to us at the moment about the impact this would have, or sort of the workability of these proposals?
Well, Ellie, you'd think that I'd be able to talk to you about what kind of modelling and data is in place and present right now. Alas, I can't, because there isn't any. You'd think, right? We're looking at potentially a very significant change, absolutely huge change to our system. And you'd think that you would make those decisions based on data and modelling and various and seeing what kind of outcomes you could achieve. Alas, none. I can give you one piece of data, which comes from the US, and that is a model that a mathematician called Jeff Suzuki has run. And he's argued that when you take a smaller jury, they actually seem to be more likely to convict where it appears that the defendant is less certain to be guilty. And that's not a good thing. So that's one piece of data, not a UK piece of data. Other things that probably should have been modelled and aren't are extended hours. That's being put forward as a way forward, being overwhelmingly rejected by the profession at this point in time. I don't know if anyone has seen the Bar Council's official Twitter account's tweet of the pig flying when Robert Buckland stated that barristers were in favour of it. So that the pilot outcome for the flexible operating hours hasn't actually been released, so we don't know what that data shows. But I don't think that's a particularly promising sign. And you know, counsel don't want to work extended hours in court, because we work extended hours outside of court. That's when we conduct our preparation. We're people, we have private life and family responsibilities, and yet another area that hasn't had modelling is, are we creating a two-tier system? Because if we are suggesting that a fair way forward for a type of offence would be to have a smaller jury or no jury if you have a judge and two magistrates, are you implying that the more serious offences deserve the better system and the full 12 jury panel? Are you saying that one justice system is better than the other? Even in World War II, there was no seven juror situation in case of treason or murder. Again, these are just talking points, because when it comes to actual numbers, I'm afraid I've got nothing to give you at this stage.
Victoria there mentioned really important points about fairness and prejudice. And presumably, Mariam, there are legal issues and legal implications to be considered, as some of these are quite a significant departure from conventional practice. What sort of legal questions do you foresee arising?
Well, Ellie, I think that's a very key point that you very, very rightly raise. And I think, you know, even just at the most basic level, talking about having Blackstone or Nightingale courts, the reason we haven't got them is that because, never mind security considerations, funding and staff, it actually requires legislation. So the government would have to actually pass a bill, which could happen quickly, to actually put that into effect. And then it's just legal considerations in relation to how would trials operate. If, for example, it was a judge sitting with two magistrates, well, that's akin to how I often sit when I sit as a recorder in the Crown Court deciding appeals. Now, in that sort of scenario, I am alone of the judge of law, and the magistrates have no function in terms of making legal rulings on admissibility and things like that. Is that how it would operate if that replaced a jury system? And also, we're up to over 50,000 now jury trials in backlog. Could the idea of that being offered as an election, i.e. a defendant can try choose whether he wants to be tried rather than a jury by a judge and two magistrates, can that be applied retrospectively to defendants who are already in the system because they're expecting jury trials, because either they've chosen that or because the offences are so serious that they are indictable only? And if, for example, you had three judges, then who would make those rulings? And would there have to be written reasons for verdicts and things like that? And also, legally, in terms of jury numbers, the question of what would be a majority verdict? Would people press for the fact that it has to be unanimous because it's down to seven, for example? So how would that work as a matter of law? So that's a really important point you raise.
Well, as well as all of those considerations, there's also concern, of course, about the need for fact finders to be diverse and representative of the wider community and society, which is obviously essential to the legitimacy of the legal system. Victoria, what do you think are some of the challenges in this respect?
Well, Ellie, I'm not... I'm going to use the word BMAE in this circumstances just because this is what the data gathering uses as a term. We know that a lot of people do not like the term, do not subscribe to that term. So I just want to make clear that's the only reason I'm going to be using this term when answering your question. Diversity is a massive issue, particularly when it comes to magistrates. What do we know about diversity within the magistrates' court? Well, we know that in terms of social background, there's no data collection, but insofar as a Justice Commons Committee report is concerned in 2019, it was pointed out that about 2/3 of the magistrates that had responded to the most recent survey were not actually in employment. And there have also been concerns raised about the tap of the shoulder culture of recruitment of magistrates. What do we know in terms of racial diversity figures? We know that about 11.5% of magistrates come from BMAE backgrounds. And that might at first glance actually not seem that bad, because the BMAE population in the UK is about 13.8% at this point. But as we know, there is a really significant overrepresentation of people from BMAE backgrounds within the criminal justice system. And so are magistrates actually going to be the defendant's peers where there is an overrepresentation? Possibly not. What else do we know? We know that there are certain groups such as Somali or Roma and Gypsy that are not at all represented by the magistracy. And I think that is a really, really, really serious concern, because if you're going to replicate the experience of the jury and a lived experience, people come from different backgrounds for a jury. certainly know from the data in relation to magistrates that more than half of magistrates are over 60. Does that replicate the diversity that a jury brings? Possibly not.
Mariam, you're one of the first Muslim women to be appointed Crown Court judge. What's your view about the significance of the role of lived experience of judges, but also juries in the Crown Court?
Well, Ellie, I think it's a very, very important point. At the moment, only 4% of circuit judges are what is designated as BAME. There is a real concern about the lack of black male judges. In terms of Crown Court recorders, it was initially 5%, and it's now gone up to 7%. But it's not just a question of race. It's also about sex and about class and about the fact that one of the reasons why juries are so revered is because many feel that what they want is an experience of being judged by a jury of their peers. So somebody that reflects them and reflects the society that they come from. And although there has been a great deal of effort and work put in to increasing diversity amongst the judiciary, to be more inclusive, to be more representative, and with training and unconscious bias training, it's affording confidence and those who appear as accused in trials, that the fact finders who are actually deciding about the very cases they face really understand their, you know, we've used the phrase, and it's an important phrase, the lived experience, so that they really have confidence that they're getting a fair trial. And I think perhaps that's one of the issues that has caused the conversation to move more towards having juries, but having them in smaller numbers.
And in terms of those juries, maybe with smaller numbers and the potential practical realities and procedure, Victoria, what should we be considering there?
Well, Ellie, I'll answer your questions in two parts, if I may, because I think there's a different type of reality at play that comes before we look at the number of jurors. And that is what happens if there is a second wave and we do end up getting rid of juries altogether in certain either way offences and have a judge and two magistrates. Mariam's already touched on this topic. We know that there is a really significant division of labour within the context of a jury trial. Judges always tell juries, I am the judge of the law, you are the judges of facts. And so this system, which is so valuable, really enables the two judges, if you look at the judge of fact and judge of law analogy, to concentrate on their task. The jury can sit and listen to the evidence for its evidential value. The judge can listen to the evidence, but can ensure that it is presented properly within the framework that it has to be presented in, and can really concentrate in that task at hand. And so, for example, if they're listening to someone's evidence and something starts to go wrong and some inadmissible evidence start coming out, they can immediately step in because that has been their task. I think that is an incredibly valuable procedural safeguard. It is important to try and keep that and enable people to concentrate at their best when it comes to making decisions that affect people's lives enormously. And I don't know that that would be preserved if there were no juries. What about the second point? What about the smaller jury point? Well, we don't know how the division of labour goes on when it comes to juries, but we do know there are 12 people, and so you might assume that when a group of 12 people go into a room, there is a certain division of labour that enables their deliberation to be conducted in a way that works for them. If you almost halve that group, how's that going to work? Is there something that we're perhaps not considering when it comes to how smaller and larger groups interact with each other in making assessments? Again, no, that's a reality at play, but there's no data on that. And finally, as Mariam has already touched upon, what about the issue of majority verdicts? There is a provision for majority verdicts right now, and is that going to be able to be kept if juries are smaller?
Mariam, Victoria there mentioned the possibility of a second wave, and it's clear that this pandemic is far from over and the backlog continues to build. What concerns do you think are on the horizon, and what are the possible way forward?
Well, I think, Ellie, that is a really, really good question again. And it is the whole concern that is that we may well have a second wave when winter comes. Obviously, nobody would want that. But that is the reality that we will have to face. We already know that literally just as Leicester Crown Court was about to reopen, it suffered a local lockdown. And in fact, we've learned today that we've all received a message to say it's about to reopen again, hopefully at the beginning of August. But so they've effectively lost a good chunk of a month. And I think it's will these possibilities of changing jury trials have to be pushed forward? As we've talked about, there has been so much research done in relation to jury trials. And for example, Professor Cheryl Thomas will be known to many. And in 2010 and in 2014, she published some really important academic studies in relation to juries and how disproportionate outcomes are significantly reduced when you have juries. But there's also been research done in other jurisdictions that if you actually reduce the number of jurors, you actually increase the conviction rates because the numbers go down. And so these are the concerns that will be in everyone's minds. But also in terms of the way forward and the horizon, what are we going to do in relation to multi-handed cases? Are we going to have to just bite the bullet and split them up and say that you can only have cases involving three defendants, or that if you have young or vulnerable defendants, you have to split them up? Perhaps the young defendants get remitted to the youth court. So these are all things that eventually are going to have to be talked about.
And Victoria, what are your thoughts about the way forward?
I think the key point is we have got to be ready. And the only way that we can get ready for a potential second wave, which no one wants, but everyone should prepare for, is by investment and research, but mostly investment. Investment in emergency courts, investment in increasing the physical capacity and sitting dates. But it has to be in a way that is fair and that isn't rushed, because there is absolutely no point of having a justice system that is functioning on the surface in terms of being able to get through cases quickly or in a way that is perceived to be rapid. But if it's not fair, it's not worth having. So it is absolutely imperative that any preparation that is conducted preserves the fairness of our criminal justice system and identifies areas of potential unfairness and deals with them. Mariam has cited Professor Cheryl Thomas's research and the way that jury trials at the moment are essentially the only part of the criminal justice system where people, and again, word BMAE with the caveat that I raised before, that BMAE defendants are not disproportionately penalised. So if there is even the prospect of interfering with that, that has to be considered and that has to be dealt with. Another thing that I think is worth considering in terms of preparation is we have to make parties to a criminal trial feel safe. That's court staff, jurors, defendants, witnesses, everyone. And particularly when it comes to juries or people that are fact finders, we have to make sure that they feel safe enough that they can concentrate to the task at hand. And then they're not sitting in court being half frightened of what might happen to them in terms of exposure to COVID-19 and with the other ear listening to evidence. That is not likely to result in a fair outcome for people. And we have to be aware of that.
And Mariam, your final thoughts?
Well, Ellie, I think looking at the reality of the way forward we might be moving, I think it is going to be with suggestions of extended hours. I'm sure many of you remember the London riots that took place a number of years ago and courts ran extended hours, often sometimes till late at night. I think it will be asking if the court estate can be effectively extended in terms of different buildings. We understand the impetus in the interest of justice to deal with the backlog expeditiously, but it is really the sort of balancing act of deciding what is the fairest way that this can be achieved. And I know this discussion will clearly evolve further.
Mariam Syed and Victoria Tredilio, thank you very much for your time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of 7BR's Part Heard. It's clear that debates about how best to reduce the backlog are ongoing, and there's still much to consider. So Mariam and Victoria will be hosting a webinar on the subject in the coming months to discuss this further, details of which will be circulated and publicised on Chamber's website once confirmed. Do join me next time, when I'll be talking to Jim Rowbottom about what the news of the working conditions in Leicester's garment factories tell us about the law of modern slavery, enforcement practices, and corporate responsibility.